accession number 28361, reel 38.
General Julian Thompson, reel 38. I was asking about the Austrians and their, what they showed you when you went.
They showed us very little, the Austrians. We went to visit a division and looked around some of their kit. We went to see, I think it was a Steyr works where they make their rifles.
Yes.
But most of the time I spent on a very agreeable sort of touristy type visits around Austria, led by the very enthusiastic military attaché, British military attaché, who was a great expert on Austrian history. So we had a very agreeable time driving around in a coach and visiting places like Marling and other bits of Austrian history. But we didn't actually learn too much about the Austrian armed forces.
Did you see enough to get an impression of the Austrian army when you went to see the division?
The impression I got was that the sort of higher levels were quite efficient, and the lower levels are rather disinterested, which is a fairly sort of normal, I would have thought, reflection of a conscript army, that it's going through the motions of doing 1 year's service, and then you have this professional officer corps sitting at the top, which is on the whole underemployed, and spends its time either at staff college or doing sort of study or even doing things like business studies to try and qualify itself for better jobs outside.
Of course, the Austrian army also was limited, I think, something like 30,000.
Yes, it was a very small
number,
army.
So it wouldn't...
No, it was very small. I don't think we looked at their air force, and of course they haven't got a navy now.
No. And Portugal?
Portugal was interesting in one respect, in that 1980, they'd only just come out of the sort of 74, I think it was, revolution that they'd had, which was a fairly gentle revolution, as revolutions go, which had resulted in them their precipitate departure from their African territories, leaving them in some chaos. And it had split the country down the middle and divided it, actually, on almost a north-south basis. The north, round Oporto, was far more right-wing than the south around Lisbon. And there were hints in conversations, usually late at night, that had the revolution gone a certain way, it might have split the country on those lines, that the army might have pulled back to the north and said, we'll do what you like down there, but this is what's going to happen up here. And you could have had some kind of military dictatorship. Yeah. Had it gone wrong. I got the impression of it was then a very third world country. Very poor, great fun. I liked the area in the north around Oporto, not just for its product, but the people I found. And one of the other things was interesting is we went to the battlefield of Busaco because it happened to coincide with the one of the anniversaries of the battle, and the Portuguese still celebrated. So we went up onto that ridge and saw them all celebrating this battle.
Were they doing a reenactment?
They were doing a reenactment, and we were then given a meal by the Portuguese army, which was one of the most disgusting meals I've ever had in my life. I was very glad I wasn't a Portuguese soldier. But that was interesting. But we didn't see much of Portuguese armed forces, because there aren't much to see, really.
Well, I think one of the reasons for the revolution was that the army senior command realised that the conscripts were virtually on the brink of mutiny, because they were fed up with the... commitment to Africa.
Absolutely, that was the reason.
And
the commitment to Africa
was never ending.
Was never ending. Was open ended, and it was a disaster. But it's quite interesting, because in later life I've been to Angola, and so I've seen the sort of the other end of it. Mm. And that's quite interesting too.
Did they discuss the war in Africa at all? The Portuguese?
Yeah, the Portuguese army officers would talk about it. Not very much, but they would. Mm. And it was. I found them rather sad, actually. And they didn't seem to have a purpose in life. And it was all backward looking at their sort of past, you know.
Well, once the African Empire is gone, what is there for an officer in the Portuguese armed forces to do?
Well, I suppose NATO.
There is NATO.
If you're in the Navy, you've probably got some things. You've got the Atlantic.
You've got the Atlantic, but if you're in the Army,
yeah,
then the threat is an awful long way to the east.
Exactly. That was, you know, very much what I gathered. I mean, the Portuguese Navy still had a task.
Yes.
The Portuguese Air Force still had a task in probably maritime surveillance and that sort of thing. But the army didn't really. Mm. So, but it was interesting because I'd never been there before.
Did you go down to the south at all, to the area south of Lisbon?
No. No, we were between Oporto and Lisbon.
Yeah. So it was in the area south of Lisbon that they had at one time a fairly substantial Maoist movement.
Oh, did they? Right.
In the great estates that were owned by absentee noble landlords.
Yes.
And they had.
No, we didn't go down there. Mm. Mm. And then we went to Spain, to Madrid. And we saw quite a bit of the Spanish. We didn't see the Spanish Navy at all. We saw the Spanish Air Force a bit. We went to watch a exercise in the training area, and I'm not sure where the training area was. It was about an hour or plus or more flight in an ancient old aeroplane, sort of Dakota type aeroplane.
Probably was a Dakota.
Probably was, which frightened all our Air Force members, including the commandant of the RCDS, who was an Air Chief Marshal, didn't like it at all. He liked it even less when, in lunch, during the exercise, we had lunch in a sort of lavish marquee with very nice food, and he noticed that the crew of our aeroplane were knocking back the Spanish brandy like there was no tomorrow, and sort of flying back with these cookies. He didn't amuse him at all. But we did see quite a lot of them, and again, it's quite interesting, because we met a couple of officers who'd fought in the Blue Division in Russia. Senior chaps, you know, they were sort of generals by then, and because you couldn't really talk about Franco, it was sort of tactless to talk about him, but you could sort of
get
hints
close.
How about you get Herco's talking about it, particularly when we went to Toledo, where we saw the I can't remember what it's called now, but there's a building, there's a castle there, which was besieged by the Alcazar.
Oh, the Alcazar, yes.
Besieged by the Republicans, and held out. And the son of the garrison commander was captured, and they threatened to shoot him if he didn't surrender. And he told his son, you know, I'm afraid you're going to have to be shot. And he was. Mm. So he was a great hero.
My son, you must be brave.
Yes. But it was interesting going there, because you pick up some of these sort of, from what how they tell the story, you pick up the sort of the subtext of what they think. Mm. And there's an officer training place there as well, if you went to, there, sort of Sandhurst, I think, is there, isn't it? Mm.
Yes. What were they thinking then at that time?
Well, what they were thinking was that they were only they better start getting into NATO, because this would give the army a role. Because without NATO, the enemy is a long way away, and till then the army had been very much the sort of arm of keeping the country together and in one place, and was very much a sort of relic of the Civil War. Yeah. And I don't know what the Navy thought or the Air Force. We didn't talk to them much, but their feeling was a wish to get more integrated into NATO. Now, I don't know, are they members of NATO now? It shows my ignorance. Mm. I can't remember when they joined it.
No, I can't remember.
I don't think they were members of it in 1980. Mm. The other thing that came across was how the monarch had saved the country from another round of revolution.
Yeah.
And how the monarch had acted and continued to act in 1980, I don't know if it applies now, as a sort of lightning conductor for discontent from the army officer. Because he did a sort of smoke and mirrors trick with himself. I mean, I'm talking about the army officer, in that politicians did things which he disapproved of for one reason or another, but he was able to sort of say, well, they're not really my bosses. My boss is the king. And if he's able to put up with it, then so am I. So, though I don't like what they're doing, they don't actually command me. The king commands me. And they did a sort of thought transference like that, which I found quite an interesting point of view, actually.
Well, I think, wouldn't you find in Britain that many officers would think in a rather abstract way that they don't serve the government, so when they're serving the state.
That's right.
The government gives them their orders.
Yes.
But their ultimate loyalty is to the state.
That's right.
Not to any particular party in office.
Yeah, and the head of the state is the Queen.
And the head of the state is the Queen.
That's right. I think this is what the way that they thought, and I found it quite interesting.
Well, it's the strength of the constitutional monarchy, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. That's what it
provides an apolitical focus of loyalty.
That's right. Yeah. And they did and they were doing this.
Of course, I can't remember whether your visit was before or after the affair with that Colonel Tejero of the Civil Guard.
I think it was after.
Yes.
I think it was after, actually.
Because he... Now, that might have shaken them a little, because I think in that case it transpired that Tejero, the man who opened fire in the assembly...
Yeah.
Was acting under instructions from one of the captains general, a chap called Milansdale Bosch. And that Milansdale Bosch had expected the king to support some kind of military coup, and the king had told him that he couldn't support any such.
Yes, that's right. I think it was after that.
That he was determined to be a good constitutional monarch.
I think it was after that, but I may be wrong. I may be wrong.
Yes. Did the Blue Division officer say anything about their experiences in the Second World War in Russia?
The main things I remember about him is the terrible weather, the winter weather, and the what formidable soldiers the Russians were. I mean, I think those were the two impressions that he came away with.
Because they were sent up into North Russia, weren't they?
Yes.
They were in Leningrad, and they were also further north, I think, later on, Karelia.
Yeah, I think they were. Yeah. I mean, he was. I can't remember if were they volunteers, the Blue Division, or were they?
Yes. I think they were volunteers, but I think it was made clear to the people who were officers that if they didn't volunteer, then it would not be good for their career prospects.
Right. Yeah.
So if you wanted to be.
Get on in the army.
Wanted to get on in the army. It was best to go to Russia.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, he was one, and it did him all right, because I think he was at least a 3-star general.
Well, I have the impression that until late 1980s, virtually every really senior officer in the Spanish army had served in the Blue Division.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this chap was serving still.
It was the Golden Gate.
To promotion.
To high rank. Yes.
Yeah. And I can imagine why, because he's had experience in fighting a major modern war.
Yes, first-class opponent.
Yeah, exactly. But it was interesting. I found the Spanish. I think the Spanish bit was about the most interesting, because we had the most contact with the armed forces.
Did you see any of their units in training?
Well, I saw I think it was a mechanized division doing an exercise in the desert, which you only saw a bit of. I mean, you were there for a few hours, you were sort of spectator, you were watching sort of set piece things. I was quite impressed by their sort of middle ranking officers who we met for lunch. I mean, there was a lot of sort of bonhomie and that sort of thing, which might have helped give you a good impression of them. But they were pretty lively, a lot. And obviously out to sort of give a good impression.
Yeah.
And I was quite impressed by the Spanish army, actually. Mm.
They seem to have a rather professional approach to things.
Yes.
Of course, they still had the war in Africa, didn't they, at that time?
I think they did, yes.
Do you remember that being discussed?
No. I think the Legion fights most of it. It does a lot of the fighting there, doesn't it?
Mm.
I came across the Spanish Marines and Navy later, when I was a brigade commander, a year later, actually. And we can talk about that when the time comes. But I thought the Spanish army was all right. I think you had this feeling of officers and soldiers.
Yeah.
The officers are, you know, professional, well-qualified, well-educated, lot of guys, and then you've got this other lot who are probably pretty unwilling on the whole, not totally committed. And then an army that doesn't actually have a role at this stage in 1980. And longing to be a part of NATO, to have a role.
But even if they joined NATO, as they did, their role would be confined to Spain.
Sure.
They were not going to go and...
They weren't going to go and station in Germany.
Germany, no.
No, I think what they saw was as an opportunity to do exercises outside Spain and take part in discussions with allies on the whole thing, instead of being inward-looking on, you know, keeping the Spanish peasantry from rebelling and fighting a little funny war in Africa, which is what they'd been doing up to then.
Did you get a sense of the political atmosphere? You know, was there any feeling that the peasantry might be...
No, not that I got. I didn't get any feeling. I mean, I think Spain, by 1980, was so... relatively prosperous with tourism I think the economy was doing well. Madrid was sparkling, full of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen, all walking down the street like guardsmen. It was a very sort of vibrant sort of society, I got the impression.
Sounds as though the tour made a bigger impact on you than any other part of the RCDF.
Well, I think it did, really, because it was much more interesting than sitting listening to people banging on about the economy.
What happened when you came back? Did you go straight off to command the brigade?
No, what happened? The tour was in August, September, so you still had a couple of months to run.
Yes.
You then gave a sort of lecture on your tour.
Mm.
And I was the tour leader, I remember, which could be quite trying, because it was rather like being the tour guide of a bunch of recalcitrant and opinionated old people, because, you know, everyone was at least a colonel, and some were even two-star, and having the commandant, who was four-star, under one's wing as well. You had to make sure that, you know, that the buses arrived on time and that everyone knew they were meant to have their passports ready. I felt the need of a sergeant major to take charge of this lot.
Make them walk in a neat crocodile.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, you said there are a lot of overseas people on the course, and they come from a full range of countries.
Oh yes, they came from Pakistan, Egypt, China. No, we didn't have a China. Japan, Africa, all over.
Mm.
America, Germany, France, Spain. I can't remember exactly which countries, but it was a pretty wide selection.
Were they at the sort of same level, full colonel and upwards?
On the whole, they were that and above. I mean, I think the most senior chaps we had on the course were two-star.
Mm.
And many of them, particularly the Africans, were going to go on to be sort of presidents and things like that in their own countries.
Eventually,
though they might not have known it at the time, though they probably hoped so. We had Israeli, Egyptian. Fascinating, really, that side of it.
You've got your couple of months back.
Yeah.
And then what happened after that?
Well, what happened then was I then took over the commander brigade in January of 1981.
Oh.
And one thing I forgot to mention was while I was the Colonel GS, I had craftily got 4 weeks off from my chief of staff job. I persuaded my general that I ought to... I'd done some winter training years and years before, but I decided I'd like to get myself winter qualified.
Mm.
So I went and joined the brigade in Norway in 1979, before I went to the RCDS, and did the, what was known as the Arctic Warfare Training course, where we did skiing and living in snow holes and all that sort of thing at a very basic level. So I didn't then have to go and do that when I took over. I didn't have to waste 3 weeks of my command time doing that. And so I went to Norway almost straight after I had taken over the commando brigade, within a week. And so the whole thing had been set up. I just got onto a C-130 and flew to Trondheim and joined my brigade headquarters, which was already set up in a camp there.
What was the form of that exercise then?
Well, the training training was... What do you mean, the training we did in Norway?
Mm.
It was 2.5 months.
It's a very substantial length of time.
Yes, and it was designed quite liberally because it was designed to go through the normal stages of training of individual section, so all the way up to formation training, but all in that environment. So your what would be happening is at the beginning. Typically, the first first 3 weeks would be putting novices, i.e. people who'd never been there before, through this AWT, which was done collectively by units. So every unit took everyone out of its rifle companies that hadn't done it before and ran cadre courses to teach guys to ski and live in the Arctic.
And this was done around Trondheim?
No, it was done wherever the unit was. I mean, my headquarters was Trondheim. One of the commandos was down at Arndalsnes, the other was up at Bjerkvik in near Narvik.
Yes.
And so you did it, and my sappers were somewhere, my gunners were somewhere else. So you did your cadre training in by units. So you did it where you were, but it was done to a set syllabus, and you had to cover certain subjects. At the end of that 3 weeks, the novices then returned to their sections or platoons or batteries or troops or wherever, and then you started sort of section level training or
pretty doing the collective
at the lowest level.
What were the rest of the chaps doing when the novices were off doing their
own? They were doing a refresher. And then some of them, of course, were training the novices because what had happened the year before. In the scheme of things, was that you trained up a certain number of people called MSIs, called military ski instructors, who just taught to ski.
Yeah.
And so they went to study under Norwegian ski instructors at Rjukan and were then qualified on a 6-week course to teach skiing and basic survival skills. So a lot of your older hands were employed teaching the cadres, because you'd have a typical novice course, you'd have, say, probably 8 to 10 chaps and one MSI would be taking them for skiing training, how to put up a tent, how to dig a snow hole, you name it, and all the rest of it.
So this is essentially the syndicate system of training.
And you do... The novices, of course, do very basic stuff. You do a lot of ski training. At the end of your first week, you'd live in an 8-man tent together, which you put up, and you spend a night in it, and you do sentry routines, and then you go back and do more things the next week. And the next week you'd be putting a tent sheet tent up, and the final week you'd do was really spent on exercise, skiing from A to B, living in snow holes, tent sheet tents, really basic living in the Arctic, actually. That's it. Very simple tactical picture. I mean, you know, hardly anything at all, really.
Yeah, no fighting, just surviving.
Just surviving.
Mm-hmm. And moving.
And moving, mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are the essential requirements for a man to be fit to
Well, the essential requirement
keep himself effective in that sort
I think it is to have mastered the techniques of living in that harsh environment to the degree that it doesn't impinge upon his ability to live, fight and move. Mm. So it doesn't become so absorbing and so overbearing that his ability to fight is seriously weakened. Mm. He's far more worried about surviving than fighting. But after all, he's there to fight, not to survive, really.
Mm. What do you have to learn to do then?
Well, you've got to learn to avoid getting injured by the environment, getting frostbite, getting cold injuries, dehydrating to the extent that you're ineffective, being able to keep your weapon in fighting conditions so it doesn't freeze up, being able to look after all your equipment, instruments and so forth so they don't freeze up, so they're usable, being able to move, be able to use the ground, be able to camouflage yourself, be able to use your weapon, whatever it is, whether it's an anti-tank weapon or a rifle, effectively in that environment, and being able to take advantage of what the environment offers you in terms of speed and mobility on skis and so forth, without being having your fighting efficiency degraded by it.
And what sort of rate of movement would you expect to achieve with, shall we say, reasonably trained ex-novices, people who've gone through the course and done reasonably well? How far could they be expected to move in a day? During a day's march on ski?
Well, depending, the limiting factor was usually the load you were carrying. Mm. But you could certainly do 20 to 30 kilometres on skis. Mm. You know, a well-trained company would cover that. Again, it depended on the terrain, of course, too. You know, how much climbing you had to do. Mm. Did you have to negotiate avalanche areas, glaciers, go round fjords and things like that? So it did depend, but you would expect to do 20 to 30 kilometres a day.
Mm. And how much time would be devoted to protecting yourself against cold injuries?
All the time. All the time. It was drilled into you, the various things you had to do and the things you shouldn't do.
Mm. So what were those then? What were the essential things to do and not to do?
Don't overheat so that you sweat, which then freezes on you. So when you moved, after the first 20 minutes, you always had a halt, and you stripped off lots of stuff inside and left on just an outer layer, usually. Mm. I mean, you've been, and I've skied in sort of minus 20, wearing just a shirt and a windproof, with all my kit in my pack, and immediately I stop, I stick it back on again. Mm. So don't overheat, because you not only risk freezing, you dehydrate.
Is it easy to overheat if you're skiing?
Oh, yes. Mm. Very much. I mean, I've skied, again, in very, very cold conditions, just a windproof and my shirt at the end of it, I could wring out with a sweat. Mm. And you must avoid that, if you can. I can't, because I sweat a lot, but you do as much as you can. You dehydrate. And that is dangerous in two respects, because if you dehydrate, your blood gets thicker and it stops going to the extremities of your body, your toes and your fingers, because the capillaries at the end here are only big enough to take one
molecule
of blood through. Mm. And if they pinch off and it gets thick, then you start getting cold injury. And also it weakens you, of course, if you get dehydrated, and you're sweating at the same time. And then if you need plenty of liquid, the only way to get it is by melting snow. And the only way you melt snow is by heating it, and the only way you can heat it is by fuel, which you're carrying. So there's that.
It's an additional burden.
It's an extra burden. Covering up when you stop, so you don't get wind